This is VOA News, reporting by remote. I'm Joe Ramsey. Taliban insurgents entered Kabul and President Ashraf Ghani left Afghanistan on Sunday, bringing the Islamist militants close to taking over the country 2 decades after they were overthrown by a U.S.-led invasion. It's not yet clear where Ghani was headed or how exactly power will be transferred following the Taliban's lightning sweep in recent weeks across Afghanistan. Their advance accelerated as U.S. and other foreign troops withdrew in line with President Joe Biden's desire to end America's longest war, launched in the wake of the September 11, 2001 attacks. By evening, the Taliban said they had taken control of most of the districts around the outskirts of the capital. The U.S. embassy said there were reports the capital's airport had come under fire, the same airport where diplomats, officials, and other Afghans had fled. Hundreds of Afghans, some of them government ministers and government employees, and also other civilians, including many women and children, are crowded in the terminal, desperately waiting for flights out. American diplomats were flown from their embassy by helicopter to the airport as Afghan forces melted away, despite being trained for years and equipped by the United States and others for billions of dollars. Ghani's destination is uncertain. A senior interior ministry official said he had left for Tajikistan, while a foreign ministry official said his location was unknown, and the Taliban said it was checking his whereabouts. A Kabul hospital said more than 40 people were wounded and clashes on the outskirts were being treated, but there did not appear to be major fighting. Insurgents entered the presidential palace and took control of it, according to two senior Taliban commanders in Kabul. And France, Germany, the Netherlands, and Sweden all said Sunday they were moving their diplomats. This is VOA News. The death toll from a devastating earthquake in Haiti rose to 724 on Sunday as rescue workers scrambled to find survivors buried under buildings a day after a 7.2 magnitude quake and as a tropical storm begins to bear down on the Caribbean nation. The quake flattened hundreds of homes and buildings. The nation still clawing its way back from another major trembler 11 years ago and reeling from the assassination of its president last month. Southwestern Haiti bore the brunt of the blow, and churches, hotels, hospitals, and schools were badly damaged or destroyed. Some Haitians say they spent Saturday night sleeping in the open, traumatized by the memories of the magnitude 7 quake in 2010 that struck far closer to the sprawling capital Port-au-Prince and killed tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people. Libyan authorities have shut water supplies to swaths of the country after gunmen demanding the release of a jailed Gaddafi-era official threatened to sabotage the water network. The water authority says supplies to western and southwestern Libya were interrupted overnight Saturday to Sunday. It took the decision to cut the supply after the gunmen Thursday stormed several water distribution centers, demanding the release of the jailed official, a brother-in-law of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. On Thursday, gunmen gave authorities 72 hours to release him from detention in the capital, Tripoli, according to the water authority. If their demands were not met, they planned on attacking the network, which brings water from underground wells in the Sahara to Tripoli. A statement from the Great Man-Made River Authority said it was preferable to cut the water supply than see it damaged in any potential attack. A team of 200 Chinese police, emergency workers, and experts on Sunday were trying to reach 19 coal miners trapped in a flooded mine in the northwest province. State media reported Saturday rescuers have retrieved 2 workers already from the mine, one of whom died. Local authorities say the mine was ordered by the province to stop operating and fix safety hazards on August 2nd, with work still underway. A flood in April at a coal mine in northwestern Xinjiang region left over 24 miners trapped. And a Hong Kong pro-democracy group that organized some of the biggest protests during months of political upheaval in 2019 is dissolving, the group said Sunday. The Hong Kong Civil Human Rights Front, made up of a slew of member organizations, says it can no longer operate. Local media reports the decision comes as the group faces a police investigation for possible violation of a national security law. Earlier this week, the city's largest teachers union disbanded in light of what it said were drastic changes to the political environment. Reporting by remote, I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga. Somalia receives more than 300,000 doses of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine.
This is something that we are doing with the singular aim of saving lives, because we do believe firmly that vaccines are the best path forward in ending this pandemic and saving lives globally.
Doctors in Nigeria go on strike over unpaid salaries and poor benefits.
Enough is enough. Why we are, you know, understand the peculiarity of the time we are in. We also know that the same government is attending to other issues. So we are calling the attention to the health sector.
And Cameroon officials say at least 82 former Boko Haram fighters from Nigeria and Chad, along with their families, have surrendered to authorities in the past week.
We came to see the fighters. Those young women and men, predominantly made of Nigerians, flooding out from the Boko Haram.
Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Botswana President Mokgweetsi Masisi has announced new COVID restrictions, including extending a nighttime curfew and postponing the reopening of schools. The Southern African country has one of the world's highest COVID-19 rates per capita. From Habarondi, Botswana, Mukondisi Dube has the details.
In a televised address, Masisi said the country was seeing an exponential increase in COVID-19 cases.
The disease burden is weighing heavily on us, with infections continuing to increase across the country and precious lives being lost on a daily basis here at home and throughout our continent. Our nation has attained the highest prevalence ever.
By Friday, 1,973 people had died of COVID-19, with the death toll rising from about 300 in February. Masisi announced restrictions Friday meant to blunt the spread of the virus, including a ban on public gatherings.
Interzonal movement continues to be restricted to essential travel only. Reopening of schools will be delayed for a further 3 weeks, except for those students preparing for their final examinations. A ban on the sale of alcohol remains. Curfew will now start earlier at 8 p.m. and end at 4 a.m. for the next 3 weeks, after which there will be a review.
Masisi says the country will accelerate its vaccination program in the next 3 weeks. About 5% of the population, or 146,299 people, are fully vaccinated. The president blames the slow delivery of vaccine for the frustrating pace of inoculation.
Of course, it saddens me that many have not received a single dose of COVID-19 vaccine, and they are obviously exasperated. It may look like government is not trying hard, but I can assure you that the opposite is true.
Education unions welcomed the government's decision to postpone the reopening of schools. The unions had urged their members not to return to class until they are vaccinated. Botswana Federation of Public Sector Union Secretary General Dabogani Rari says the government should use the three-week break to vaccinate teachers.
Yes, it's a progressive step that the president has found it fit that, because of the pressure that was coming from the trade unions, postpone the reopening of the schools. However, we have not heard anything from the president or even the Minister of Basic Education as to whether during the 3 weeks that the schools would be closed, there would be any plan where teachers would be vaccinated in a sort of a fast-tracked manner.
This week, Botswana took its first delivery from Johnson & Johnson, with 108,000 doses arriving. The country also received 38,400 doses of AstraZeneca on Sunday, August 8, with hopes the deliveries will help accelerate the vaccination program. Mkondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone, Botswana.
Somalia has received more than 300,000 doses of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine. The doses donated by the U.S. through the International COVAX facility will be the first single-dose vaccines to be distributed in Somalia. Mohamed Kahir reports from the capital, Mogadishu.
Somali health authorities received 302,000 doses Thursday of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 vaccine through the COVAX facility. Dr. Ahmed Hussein Malim, Somalia's Deputy Minister for Health, expressed gratitude to the U.S. government for the donation. He says the vaccines they received from the U.S. will help the cap of the virus in the country and boost efforts by health authorities to control the pandemic. According to President Joe Biden, Washington has shipped more than 110 million doses of the vaccines to 65 nations so far. U.S. officials in Mogadishu said the primary goal of the donation is to save lives.
This is something that we are doing with the singular aim of saving lives, because we do believe firmly that vaccines are the best path forward in ending this pandemic and saving lives globally.
Anita Kikigebo, the Deputy UN Special Representative in Somalia, said the vaccines help protect Somalis against COVID-19. And are an important step towards a return to normalcy.
This is a part of a global effort, an effort to support countries to be able to vaccinate their people. We know it's a long road on the continent, it's a long road in Somalia, to make sure particularly the frontline workers and the most vulnerable are vaccinated.
Somalia has registered more than 16,000 coronavirus cases and 864 fatalities since the first case was recorded in the country in March 2020. There has been a surge in recent weeks, and in the past 48 hours, 92 people tested positive across the country. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
And Malawi has also received its first consignment of Johnson & Johnson vaccines, a donation made by the United States under COVAX, a campaign to provide equitable access to COVID-19 shots worldwide. Lameka Masina reports from Blantyre.
The arrival of 302,000 doses comes a few weeks after Malawi announced it will start inoculating its citizens with several COVID-19 vaccines, in an effort to protect more of its population amid growing infections. Health Minister Kumbize Kandodo Chiponda said the move aims to fill the gap created by the scarcity of the Britain-made AstraZeneca vaccines the country has been using. Speaking to reporters in Lilongwe, Chiponda sought to offer reassurances that the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is safe.
And most of the countries in Europe, in America, and indeed in Africa, most of the countries already are using Johnson & Johnson, and it has proven that indeed it is providing the much-needed immunity.
Besides vaccines manufactured in the West, Malawi has also used vaccines produced in China and Russia. This brings the number of vaccines doses Malawi has received so far through COVAX to more than 850,000. Jerry Meneske is charged with affairs at the U.S. Embassy in Malawi. He says the recent donation is part of the U.S. government's global vaccine sharing strategy, which aims to provide at least 80 million doses to countries most affected by the pandemic, including at least 25 million to African countries.
The first tranche of the U.S. government's commitment to Africa is 15 million doses, of which these 300,000 that are arriving today. We're working with our partners here in Malawi, the Ministry of Health, and across the continent with the African Union and the African CDC to deliver vaccines.
Health Minister Chiponda said the vaccine has given Malawi hope of reaching its target of vaccinating 60% of its people by December 2022. As of now, the country has only vaccinated 0.2% of the targeted 11 million people. Malawi has recently faced continuous vaccine shortages, largely because of huge demand as infections rise. COVID-19 is the disease caused by the coronavirus. The Minister of Health has said that since Saturday, Malawi has confirmed 481 cases with 29 deaths. The US-based Johns Hopkins University, which is tracking the global pandemic, says Malawi has currently about 55,700 cases and 1,805 deaths. Chief Onda says Malawians should not panic as more vaccines are coming.
Of course, we'll be receiving AstraZeneca in the next 2 weeks, about maybe 200,000 doses. And also we have in the pipeline Pfizer as well. It is going to come. So between now and September, we're very sure that we're going to get over a million doses of different vaccines.
Separately, Chief Onda said Malawi is planning to purchase 1.8 million doses of AstraZeneca vaccine. The government is advising people who received one jab of the AstraZeneca vaccine not to combine it with the Johnson & Johnson shot, which is a single-dose vaccine. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Doctors in Nigeria are on strike over unpaid salaries and poor benefits. The strike by some 40% of the medical workforce comes amid a fresh wave of coronavirus infections severely straining the country's healthcare system. Timothy Obiezo reports from Abuja.
ANAHP's Sarah Igwe is visiting Abuja's National Hospital for a post-surgery appointment for a second time since the National Association of Resident Doctors, or NARD, began their strike on July 2nd. The 62-year-old underwent surgery last month to address bleeding in his colon. He says he was unable to see a doctor during his first visit last week and is hoping to get lucky this time round.
I did a laboratory test, the results were out, but because I was no doctor, I have to wait for a whole week until yesterday when I got there. I have to wait for a long, long time.
NARD, which represents about 40% of Nigeria's medical workforce, is protesting unpaid salaries and what the association says are poor working conditions and benefits for its members. The doctors' union is also accusing Nigeria's health authorities of falling short on promises made earlier this year to meet these demands. Those promises led the group to call off a strike in April after a 10-day walkout. Jerry Isogun, Secretary General of the association, says their patience is at an end.
Enough is enough. Why we are, you know, understand the peculiarity of the time we are in, we also know that the same government is attending to other issues. So we are calling the attention to the health sector. Let us prioritize the health sector.
However, the latest strike is raising concerns as Nigeria confronts a third wave of the coronavirus triggered by the deadly Delta variant. Last Wednesday, the country reported over 700 new cases of the coronavirus, the highest daily rate in many months, signaling a third wave is in full swing. Health authorities say the strike is ill-timed and will have consequences. Health Board Director Ndayo Iwat says the medical salary issues is complicated and does not solely rest on health authorities.
When just like minimum wage, because that's how the federal government is looking at it, minimum wage that, the minimum wage for the federation is so and so. So states should be able to take that up and pay accordingly, but sometimes that they don't have the capacity to do it.
NART says doctors will remain on strike unless all their demands are met. Meanwhile, this week, the Medical and Dental Consultants Association of Nigeria, MDCAN, also threatened to go on strike by Monday over remuneration for its members. This is bad news for patients like Sarah Igbe and Nigeria's already stretched public health system. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The next
United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says only about half of the children in Africa are actually registered at birth, which means about one in two are deprived of a legal existence. Mavis Ochere in Juaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana has more.
UNICEF says 96 million children on the African continent were without a birth registration, and with current trends due to the coronavirus pandemic, the number would top 100 million by 2030. Cecilia Modva is the child protection specialist for the UNICEF Regional Office for West and Central Africa. She says a child without a legal identity can face problems accessing health care, education, and future employment. It also puts children at risk of being exploited. She says although many countries on the continent are striving to achieve the Sustainable Development Goal of ensuring universal birth registration by 2030, the effort must speed up to meet that goal.
Part of this initiative and the partnership between UNICEF and the African Union and all the attention that is being drawn to this issue is really to need for radical acceleration, because although there is a small trend of progress, this is far from enough to take us where we need to be by the end of this decade.
Modva says the COVID-19 pandemic has cut into birth registration because many governments have disrupted services to keep the spread of the coronavirus. She says the good news is that there is increasing evidence of what works in boosting registrations. The No Name campaign launched by UNICEF and the African Union highlight proven solutions being tested in several countries. She says countries are moving away from manual systems of recording and storing data and introducing modern technologies to digitize data and increase storage capacity. Modva says improved interoperability with other services, particularly healthcare, has been a game changer for birth registration.
If birth registration becomes an automatic process that's connected to health services, then the coverage automatically increases drastically, just because the health services have a much larger coverage than civil registration in general. So that means making birth registration totally integrated to health services, so that the child is registered immediately after birth at the maternity ward, and those that are not born in health facilities can be captured through routine vaccination.
She says countries such as Burkina Faso, Guinea, Cameroon, Guinea-Bissau, and Nigeria are testing interoperability with health services on a small scale. Modva says Ghana and Senegal are among the countries that have made some progress towards universal coverage for birth registration, and Cape Verde and Congo-Brazzaville are probably the countries close to universal coverage of birth registration. She says one key tool in increasing birth registration is to make it free.
Countries need budgeted plans for implementation at scale. Essentially, that's where the difference lies. And ensuring, again, is for the service to become universal, governments must also ensure that it's totally free of charge, because poverty is a key issue when you look at the reasons for unregistration. So unless it's free of charge, it will be very difficult to achieve the universal coverage.
Birth registration is an issue of social justice and governance, Modva says, so it should be prioritized at the highest level. Without proper birth registration, she says governments cannot properly plan and budget for efforts to contain illness such as COVID-19, such as vaccination programs. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Jaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
Cameroonian officials say at least 82 former Boko Haram fighters from Nigeria and Chad, along with their families, have surrendered to authorities in the past week. Authorities say they are the latest among hundreds of the militant Islamists who have been defecting since May, when the group's leader was killed. Cameroon plans to deport the former fighters as the influx has overwhelmed rehabilitation centers along the border. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon's government on August 10 said its National Committee for Disarmament, Demobilization and Reintegration Center in Mary, a northern town on the border with Nigeria, has 967 former jihadist militants. A week ago, there were about 700 former Boko Haram fighters and their families in the center. Among the over 260 who arrived within the past 1 week are 82 former Boko Haram male fighters. The others are women and children. Francis Fayengo is the director of DDR centers created by the government of Cameroon for former fighters. He says over 200 of ex-militants are Nigerians. He spoke on Monday after President Paul Biya sent him to meet the former militants and to evaluate their needs.
We came to see the fighters, those young women and men, predominantly made of Nigerians, flooding out from the Boko Haram hands into our country. The numbers are increasing daily. We welcome them, but after we have done the necessary verifications, we send them back rapidly to their country because of the good relationships that our country has with our neighboring country to the west.
Yango said several of the former militants are Chadians. He said Biya has provided space and funds for a bigger DDR center to be constructed in Mimi, another northern town not far from Nigeria. Yango said the center at Meri was too small to contain the increasing number of fleeing Boko Haram militants. The multinational joint task force of the Lake Chad Basin that is fighting the jihadist group said the former militants handed themselves to troops around the Sambisa forest on the Cameroon-Nigeria border, an area considered as Boko Haram's stronghold. The task force is made up of troops from Niger, Cameroon, Chad, and Nigeria. Nigeria has not issued a statement on the militants' defections. Cameroon says it has voluntarily handed former combatants to Nigeria several times, but that the number that surrendered this week is the highest. This month, Cameroon said since May, when Boko Haram leader Abubakar Shekau was declared dead, the jihadist group Boko Haram and its fighters are weaker and likely to surrender. Swaibu Issa is a researcher on Boko Haram at the University of Marwa. Issa says Cameroon, Nigeria, and Chad should encourage fighters who are still reluctant to surrender and help to reconstruct their communities. He says rival jihadist groups are carrying out charitable acts around the Lake Chad Basin aimed at luring in Boko Haram militants and having fighters join other terrorist groups.
Le discours de l'Iswap tel qu'on l'a vu aux abords du Lac Tchad.
Issa says within the past 2 months, the Islamic State in West Africa province, or the Iswap, a splinter of Boko Haram, is increasingly gaining power and influence. He says Iswap has been highly active along the Cameroon-Nigeria-Chad border. He says while recognized international aid groups distribute food to populations in need, ISWAP also shares food to gain sympathy and recruit civilians. Speaking through the messaging platform WhatsApp from Marwa, Issa said it is possible that many militants want to surrender but fear reprisals from jihadist fighters. Kalbasu Daniel is the president of Cameroon's Far North Regional Council, or the CPDM party created by the government to speed up local development. Kalbasu says it is imperative for the governments of Cameroon, Nigeria, and Chad to provide jobs for the ex-jihadist militants. He says the former militants who surrender must be encouraged to have self-confidence that is needed before they can reintegrate work for development and become productive contributing members of society. Boko Haram terrorists have been fighting to establish an Islamic caliphate in Nigeria's northeast. The fighters began attacks inside Cameroon in 2014. According to the UN, 30,000 people have been killed and 1.8 million displaced in Cameroon, Nigeria, and Chad since 2009, when the fighting deteriorated into an armed conflict with Nigerian government troops. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Malawi had nearly 7 million malaria cases last year, more than a third of the population, with 2,500 lives lost to the mosquito-borne disease. However, one village has become a model for how to eradicate malaria, and in June was honored as the first ever to have zero malaria cases for a whole year. Lameka Masina reports from Machinga district in southern Malawi.
Margaret Gachere, a resident of Mwigara village, recounts a day in 2009 when her family of five children was about to lose their second-born child to malaria. She says that day her body was too hot and she would often faint. I took her to a traditional healer, but it did not help. It was so terrible that one could not sleep. This forced me to take her to the hospital the following day, where she got help after diagnosed with malaria. Kachere's family members are among thousands in Mwigara village who have long been affected by malaria, largely because of beliefs and misconceptions against the use of mosquito nets as a preventive measure. She says, we believed that if one sleep under a mosquito net, they would suffer from loss of libido. And also, if that one sleeps under the net, would die soon, because the net symbolizes a coffin. So we were afraid to sleep under the mosquito net. But the community-driven anti-malaria campaign, which started in 2016, has changed that perception. Now, Mwikala, home to over 12,000 people, has become a model village for combating malaria. In June of this year, Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera honored the village's chief for reducing malaria infection and for recording zero cases since 2017. Chakwera spoke during the televised launch of the nationwide anti-malaria campaign in Machinga district. He said, what this village has done has given me hope that if everyone follows what they do, the campaign to make Malawi free from malaria is possible. Malaria is the number one killer disease in Malawi and accounts for 36% of hospital outpatients and 15% of hospital admissions. Last year alone, malaria killed 2,500 people in Malawi, more than any other disease, including COVID-19. The village's award is owed to a group of community volunteers who taught the villagers about malaria prevention measures. Their activities include drama, community health talks, and door-to-door campaigns. This has forced people from surrounding villages to learn about the measures. And also, the village chief augmented the campaign by formulating laws that require villagers to use mosquito nets. Yasin Mustafa is a senior chief for Mwikara village. He says, I have introduced the bylaws to prevent people from abusing mosquito nets. Some people would sell the free mosquito nets to fishermen, so anyone disobeying the bylaws would pay a fine of $6. He says, I use the money, buy the mosquito net, and I give it to those who don't have. Now, Mwikara community volunteers say that funds permitting, they will take their anti-malaria campaign to nearby villages or beyond. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Machinga District, Malawi.
Militants in Mali have massacred more than 50 villagers near the borders with Burkina Faso and Niger. The area has seen increasing violence from armed Islamists, and activists are calling on authorities to act. Annie Rosenberg reports from Bamako.
Militants attacked three villages in northern Mali simultaneously this past Sunday, leaving more than 50 civilians dead and several injured. The neighboring villages of Karu, Ouattagouna, and Daoutagueft are in an area near the borders with Niger and Burkina Faso that has seen increasing, often deadly violence the past few years. Al-Mahdi Cisse is a coordinator of the collective Songhoi Chawarabatu, a group of organizations representing the Songhoi people, who make up most of the inhabitants of the Gao region, where the attacks occurred. He said through a messaging application from Bamako, the assailants shot at everything that moved, including those leaving the mosques and those returning to the village from the fields. Chawarabatu has called on the Malian government and the international community to secure the area and to disarm militants in a release statement. We can't understand how a locality like Karu, like Ouattagouna, he says, where the military camps are not even 18 kilometers away, that massacres are happening and there are not reinforcements. There are no prosecutions. We do not understand. Since a Tuareg rebellion and coup in 2012, Mali has seen both chronic political instability and increasing Islamist violence. Alioune Tine, an independent UN expert on human rights in Mali, said through a messaging application from Dakar that Islamist groups are exploiting local mineral resources, mostly gold, and are able to finance themselves. With funds and control of the local area, which is largely inaccessible by the state, they gain credibility among the local population. In reality, he says, we have, little by little, a state within the state, or two states within the state, and that is a real threat for the Malian state, for the survival of the Malian state. Mali's neighbors, Niger and Burkina Faso, are also plagued by violence from Islamist groups. The same day of the attacks in the Gao region, suspected jihadists attacked Burkinabe troops near Mali's border. 30 civilians were also killed in attacks in northern Burkina Faso last week. Tine says the Sahel needs a regional strategy, focused on all of the affected countries in the Sahel and West Africa. The problem isn't just Mali, he says. We can't just fix Mali with a national security response. We can't do this for Burkina Faso nor Niger. He says what must be made is a regional strategy with Africans that will cover the region and who are supported. This is important, supported by the international community. VOA attempted to talk to Malian authorities for this story, but they did not make themselves available for comment. Elections in Mali are scheduled for February 2022. Tine says the insecurity in Mali's center and north remains the top priority for the transitional government. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Voice of America, and you are listening to Netline Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, sports and music from our African collection. And now in Netline Africa Sports, 8 African countries have been stripped of home advantage in next month's World Cup qualifiers after their grounds were deemed unfit to host international matches, and they will now have to play their home ties elsewhere. Burkina Faso, the Central African Republic, Djibouti, Guinea-Bissau, Malawi, Mali, Namibia, and Niger have all had matches moved to neutral grounds at the start of the group phase of Africa's qualifiers for the next World Cup in Qatar. The move was a result of those countries' venues failing inspections by a team from the Confederation of African Football. The changes have been confirmed in the list of fixtures issued by FIFA for next month's opening 2 rounds of group qualifiers. Countries had been warned to upgrade their facilities or risk being banned from hosting international matches. There are 40 teams competing in 10 African groups, with only the group winners to proceed to the home and away playoffs next March, which will determine 5 African qualifiers for the finals in Qatar in late 2022. Meanwhile, the draw for the preliminary rounds of CAF Confederation Cup 2021-2022 were held on Friday at CAF headquarters in Cairo. Top-ranked clubs like RS Berkane of Morocco, Pyramids of Egypt, AS Vita Club of DR Congo, Cotton Sport of Cameroon, Enyimba of Nigeria, CX Sfaxien of Tunisia, Al Masry of Egypt, JS Saroma of Algeria,
Gor Mahia of Kenya, Orlando Pirates of South Africa, Primero de Agosto of Angola, and DR Congo's Motema Pembe were exempted from the initial round and will join the competition directly in the second round. In athletics, it's been announced that Kenya's world record holder and Olympic silver medalist Bridget Kosgei will defend her London Marathon title in this year's race on October 3rd. The 27-year-old is looking for a third successive title in London after also winning the race in 2019. Ethiopia's Shura Kitata is also returning after beating Kenyan great Eliud Kipchoge to win the 2020 men's race. The event is being run in October rather than its usual April date because of COVID precautions. This year's event will involve 50,000 runners, according to organizers. It's Sunday here on Headline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent.
Satisfaction. Satisfaction. Jubilation.
Sunday Music Spot on Mainland Africa from the English service of the Voice of America. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Join us again on Saturday. Have a very good evening.